interviewing Mike Beck, municipal agent for Salisbury, at his office at The Grove, Ethan Allen Street, Lakeville, Connecticut. The date is June 13th, 2012. What is your name?
Mike Beck.
And where were you born?
I was born in Charlotte, Michigan.
And your birth date?
4/23/54.
And your parents' names?
Beverly and Evison Beck.
And what's your educational background?
I have a BS in education.
From?
Central Michigan University.
How did you come to this area?
Okay. I first came to Lakeville in 1975 as a camp counselor at Camp Sloan. And after spending summers through 1983 here as a camp counselor and supervisor, I then moved back to the area permanently when my wife took a job at Hotchkiss.
Now, I'm going to ask a little bit about the background of Camp Sloan. Where did it start and how did it get to Lakeville?
Camp Sloan came to Lakeville in 1928. It was already a camp on Cabs Island in Long Island Sound, and it came up as the camp for the Westchester County YMCA's. And it stayed at the Westchester County YMCA's until World War II, when it went into bankruptcy. And during when it came out of bankruptcy, a judge out of Litchfield actually helped to bring it up as an independent YMCA. And it became an independent YMCA sometime in the 40s. Was it solely a sleepover camp and a summer camp until 1983.
When you came here, what was the acreage and how many campers?
In 1975, Camp Sloan had about 250 acres at its main campsite and had approximately 500 campers and 150 staff members at any one time. It also had 200 and some acres on Belgo Road up on Bird Peak. That was its outpost property.
What was the purpose of the outpost property?
Overnight camping, wilderness camping.
What were your duties as a counselor?
The counselors do everything. They live with the kids in the tents. They take them to breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And in most cases, they work in an activity during the day. And the children would move independently of the staff member. But principally, you were responsible for your seven children in your tent.
And what would be a typical day for a child as far as moving from activity to activity?
There were always three activities in the morning, two of which were the first and second period, what could have been anything from swimming, boating, hiking, arts and crafts, horseback riding, except all the different programs the camp ran. And they chose those once a week. Third period every day was a period that the child could choose to go to any activity they wanted to on that particular day. And in the afternoon, we ran two activity periods, fourth and fifth, which they also either signed up for or were assigned. Every child had to take swimming. So until they reached the dolphin stage of swimming, classification of swimming, they had to take instructional swim. So one of those activity periods was always instructional swim.
When you left in 83, how had the camp changed in acreage and student population?
Oh, I actually didn't leave camp in 83.
Ah, all right. What happened in 83 then?
In 83 is when we moved back to Lakeville permanently. And in 1983, I wrote a proposal to the camp board to go into year-round programming and to do adventure education and outdoor education on a year-round basis, which I started doing. And we did that until about 2001, I guess. 2000, somewhere in there. And then I became director of alumni relations at camp and did that until I left in, I believe, 2005.
When you started at Camp Sloan, was there a certain amount of international students that were counselors?
Yeah, small number. And originally it was purely through the Y and the Y International program, and we would have about 5 or 6 staff, international staff per camp. You know, we ran a separate boys camp and girls camp on the same site, so there would be about 10 international staff members. And then as we got further on into the 80s, BUNAC became very popular. BUNAC was a organization that brought English-speaking internationals, mostly from the UK and from Australia in particular, to the US. And as our ability to hire American staff diminished, that helped fill that gap, and so we had more international staff as we went along in the 80s and 90s.
When you did actually leave Camp Sloan, then what was the size of the camp and the number of pupils?
Let's see. When I left camp, the summer camp numbers must have been around somewhere around 450 between the two camps, and 140 staff, 130. And at that time, they'd already added also a day camp to their resident camp, and they had we had the year-round programming, which serviced I don't know what the hard numbers were on number of camper days, but about $500,000 worth of income, approximately.
When the camp physically expanded, did it buy property from local people?
Well, when it physically expanded, it expanded because pieces of property adjacent to the camp became available. And in order to protect itself and protect the camp population from encroachment, it purchased it. It purchased it both from Parsons, the Parsons family, and from Grace and Arthur Hoffman. It also, during my 10 years, sold a piece of property on a long pond that was not contiguous to the camp on Foggy Bottom Road. So it did both.
Right and so. Is there anything that you'd like to add to this part of your interview on Camp Sloan?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Shall we go on to municipal
we
agent?
We shall.
All right.
We shall.
When did you become municipal agent?
I became municipal agent in September of 2005, I believe. 2006, I don't know, somewhere in there. One of those 2 years.
From whom did you take it over?
Joe Gibbons.
And approximately, what are your duties? What do you do?
What do I do? Well, I'm responsible for overseeing the nutrition program. I counsel people on Medicare in all forms, but particularly Medicare Part D, which is, as you know, relatively new, and a big part now of all seniors' health care. I also counsel on supplemental insurance and a variety of different things to do with Medicare. I also teach the AARP safe driving course, which we run a couple times a year, and am responsible for the AARP tax aid, which provides tax services to about 100 local seniors every year.
And how long have you done this job?
It'll be 7 years in the fall.
Your math is excellent.
Well, yeah, that's why I can do taxes.
Now, when we talked before, you said there were three major changes that you had been involved with. And what are they, please?
Well, this building is a big change for us, obviously. We went from the old Grove building and secured the funding for a new building, and then demolished the old one and put the new building up. So that's that was a big change for everybody. So the new Grove building has been an important change. The other changes are really in the programming, and that is that I am a choices counselor, where other municipal agents hadn't been, which means I can counsel in the realm of Medicare Part D and supplemental insurance and Medicare insurance questions. So that's a big difference. And the tax aid used to be run purely by volunteers, and when no volunteers were available to step forward, we went ahead and took that on as an office rather than leave our seniors to go to either Torrington or Litchfield or someplace else to have that service.
Now, so you said that you oversee the nutrition.
Yeah.
Is that, I know you don't physically cook the meals.
No.
Do you have a nutritionist that designs the meals? Or
that's all done through the cornucopia, who actually provides the food Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and that's run through the Torrington Nutrition Program. But it does all of the Meals on Wheels in the Northwest region, and we're just part of that system. Our meals on Tuesdays come from Noble Horizons, and they oversee the nutrition part of that. What I have here is Karen Ellis is presently the person who's in charge of setting up and serving the lunches and doing that kind of stuff.
And there are several other programs like the exercise and knitting and fishing.
Yeah, we run a whole host of different things out of this office and out of this building, and most of them run by other volunteers. We have an exercise class on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 10. We have a knitting group that meets here on Mondays and provides hats and mittens and scarves and blankets and all kinds of things to lots of needy people. And we also, we do the AARP Safe Driving School here. We have a wonderful donation of a pontoon boat that we received.
That's what I want to hear about.
From Bill Pulver. I don't know exactly when Bill gave us that. Several years ago, at least 4 years ago. And we use it, we take seniors for boat rides around the lake after lunches, on nice afternoons in the summer. And we use it every Friday morning for our fishing club, which the wonderful state of Connecticut helped fund the start of by buying us all of the chairs and refurbishing the boat for us after we received it. It was a $5,000 grant that allowed us to put all the amenities on the boat and allows us to do both the fishing club and our touring, which is very nice.
Where do you see your job as municipal agent going in the future?
Well, I think, you know, there are, I think right now we're in a very, very tenuous spot. If the Supreme Court strikes down the Affordable Health Care Act, we're going to be in, seniors are going to be in real limbo. Because there is a lot of preventative medicine that was provided for in that, as well as a closing of the donut hole for Medicare Part D that may get flushed right out with everything else. So I think this is probably the biggest area that we're going to have to deal with in the next, a little bit anyway. I don't see this, any of this changing. You know, it frightens me to listen to some of the rhetoric that's talking about having seniors' Medicare put on a voucher system where they have to purchase their health care themselves on a yearly basis. To sort through Medicare Part D alone is difficult enough, but if you have to purchase your whole Medicare type insurance package, I just can't visualize folks in their 80s, 90s doing it. It's a very tenuous situation, I think, to think that we're going to change our Medicare system to that kind of system and say, okay, here's $6,000, go out and buy whatever insurance you can with it. Yeah, it won't
cover it.
Won't cover it, it won't work. I'm very concerned about that. The other thing I'm concerned about, and like, I don't know what to do with it, but I think it is a big question in our area, and I don't think it's just in our area. I think it's a big question for the country, is elderly women living alone. And I'm not necessarily just talking, you know, I say elderly women only because women tend to live longer than men. You know, we as men are much more likely just not to wake up or to fall down in the middle of the day and not get up. And because we tend to die earlier and die more abruptly, we don't spend any time in a nursing home or really living alone. You know, I mean, there are exceptions to that. It's not the only rule. But so, you know, it just seems to me that women with great big houses ought to invite three of their friends to live with them, and they could, that way they can take turns cooking for each other, eating good meals. They have some social interaction, even if it's grumbling at one another. And they just don't have to grumble at the cat or whatever little pet they may have. And, you know, so they're going to be mentally and physically better for a longer period of time. And I just don't think we as human beings were meant to live alone. And, you know, some kind of communal living would be important. It frees up housing, usually for a family, because those are the size homes that many of the elderly people have, are family homes, and it would free up some of their income. You know, that many elderly folks are land rich and cash poor, and you get three people to sell their house to live with one, all of a sudden there's more money. So, you know, I just think there's got to be ways to encourage that downsizing. You know, this whole bottoming out of the real estate market, I think, has really thrown a quandary to a lot of people, because that was their life savings, and as we've seen recently on the news, as much as 40% of that was lost by a lot of folks. So, you know, downsizing and having facilities and apartments and those kinds of things that allow people to downsize, I think is important, whether it's a condo or whatever. So I think housing is a question that there's no simple answer to, but we just need to keep working on.
Give me a ballpark figure. What percentage do you think of the seniors in your area utilize the programs that you offer?
It's hard to, well, if we go with just the most recent census statistics, which are the 2000, not the 2010, there are about 1,800 seniors in Salisbury. I would say that I probably see 30%.
Really? That's a low figure.
Well, you got to remember that many of them are at Noble, of that figure, and they're receiving services there, although, you know, the tax services, they come to me, that kind of stuff. But I think you know, from my standpoint, what I see are the ends. I see those people when they first start because they need Medicare explanations and ways to navigate Medicare and Social Security and all that kind of stuff. And I see people at the other end whose usually financial resources are draining, and they have to figure out how to use other services to make it happen. The stuff in the middle, those folks are usually just kind of bumping along in good shape. So, yeah, we see them at potlucks and we see them, you know, here and there. But actually, the big services we don't see so much of.
Is there any part of your job as municipal agent that I haven't covered that you'd like to discuss?
No, other than, you know, I really think that this is a trust factor thing.
It has to be.
And without gaining people's trust, you don't gain much information. So, you know, I think the thing that people who sit in this chair have to remember is, A, it's very difficult for people to ask for help, number one. So, you know, the bulk of my job is having the ability to listen and just take it in, and sometimes that's all it takes. Sometimes it takes finding information for people and giving them information and allowing them to make a thoughtful decision, but many times it's just it's a matter of listening. So I think that's a real important part. The other part about that listening is when someone brings you something, which is often the case, you know, whether it's, you know, Sally's not eating very well, or she's depressed, or, you know, somehow we need to get her some help. You have to remember that still has to come with compassion. It has to come with recognition that even though others see that person may need some help, doesn't mean they necessarily are going to be accepting of it. And it all just, you know, it all plays very under the radar kind of stuff. And so, consequently, most of my stuff goes unseen, and that's just fine with me.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're
I do
welcome.
Appreciate it.